Navy Federal is proud to serve more than 8 million members, including active duty military, the DoD, veterans, and their families. You'll receive a lifetime of membership benefits with Navy Federal, and you can easily access accounts, transfer money, pay bills, and deposit checks with the Navy Federal mobile app. Visit NavyFederal.org/MLB for more information. Call 1-888-842-6328 or download the Navy Federal Credit Union app. Message and data rates may apply. Zoro.com is where you'll find everything you need for businesses of any size in almost any industry. They have tools, equipment, and supplies for everything you need. Whether you need stuff for industries like electrical, plumbing, manufacturing, or more, Zoro's got it from brands you know and trust. And Zoro.com offers amazing customer service from real people based in the U.S. Visit Zoro.com/MLB, all in lowercase letters, to sign up for Zmail and get 15% off your first order. Hello and welcome to the Ringer MLB show. My name is Michael Bauman and I'm a staff writer at the Ringer. And here to talk to me about the American League Championship Series is my good friend and colleague, Zach Cram. Zach.
Hello. It was a lot more fun writing about these games that end super late when I was on the West Coast as opposed to the Central Time Zone.
The big thing about, and you know, not to say that you or I have it worse than anybody else, but it takes a while to come down from one of these things, because this game didn't end until close to 1 o'clock in the morning, after which, like, you know, it's not just exciting to watch, but having to put that kind of professional level concentration into the game, you know, it takes a while to wind down and go to sleep, and all of a sudden you're up the next morning. Bobby's up, you know, at the crack of dawn to record us on the West Coast, so that is sort of a double-edged sword there. But
it feels like this game just ended. What a fun game.
I have to say, I had a very brief dreamless sleep last night, so it essentially did just end as far as I'm concerned. So this 5-hour epic, game 2 of the American League Championship Series, we're recording, what year is it? It's 11 o'clock on Monday morning on the East Coast in 2019, the last time I checked. So we are recording. Hopefully we will definitely get this out before game 3, the NLCS. But if you're listening to the American League half of this, you'll have a full day to go listen to that. So just to put this podcast in space and time and explain why I sound a little loopy right now. Anyway, this was a five-hour game. The Astros win 3-2 on a walk-off home run by Carlos Correa to even the series. You wrote about this game. What are your takeaways?
So I think this wasn't the most dramatic game of the playoffs. The stakes weren't quite as high as they were in, say, game 5 of the Dodgers-Nationals series. But I think it was probably, from top to bottom, the best played game of the playoffs. The defenses were clean and in some instances spectacular. The pitching was phenomenal. The hitting, I mean, it's kind of a zero-sum game, but the hitters weren't overmatched. It was battle after battle after battle, and that's part of why this game dragged on for so long. I think there were 15 pitchers used and only 5 runs scored, and it was just really impeccably played from both sides and kind of reaffirmed for me why I think these are, with no disrespect to the Nationals, the two best teams left from first player on the roster to 25th, from pitching to hitting. It's really the matchup of super teams we expected.
Yeah, and the point you make about it being a zero-sum game, I think, is instructive, because it was a relatively low-scoring game between two of the best offenses, not just in the league this year, but in the entire history of Major League Baseball. Where that really hit home for me was in the ninth inning, when Aroldis Chapman had that clean inning, but he threw 25 pitches, and he faced 4 batters. Each of them saw at least 5 pitches, and it drove home, like, these are absolute top end hitters doing the best. You know, they're making outs because there is no way to reach base. Just the way George Springer, in particular, near the end of that inning, really battled and stretched out his pitch count. And, you know, we saw what happened once the Astros got into the softer elements of the, or I guess Chapman pitched the 10th. Did I get that wrong?
He pitched the 9th. The 10th was the inning with Sabathia and Loaisiga and Happ.
Okay. Oh, and Correa
was the 11th.
Yeah. Okay. So anyway, running off the pitch count like that prevented Aaron Boone from using Aroldis Chapman for a second inning, which the way he was pitching, I think would have probably extended the game a little longer. But you really saw, that's really where I grappled with what you were talking about the most, that this is just the absolute highest skill level version of the game that exists right now.
And it's easy to make comparisons between this series and the 2017 meeting between the teams, but I think, and that went seven games, it was a classic, but both of these teams are better than they were in 2017. Just looking at the lineups, like Carlos Correa is a superstar and he's hitting seventh. And Gary Sanchez in game one was hitting seventh. If you compare the lineups now to the lineups in 2017, the Yankees have replaced players like Chase Headley and Starlin Castro with Gleyber Torres and Edwin Encarnacion. And the Astros have added Michael Brantley and Yordan Alvarez. And I think the lineups, you could say the number nine hitters on each team are fairly weak, but one through eight, they're fantastic. The pitching staffs, I mean, I thought the Yankees staff was their weakness, and they have held Houston, the second best lineup of all time by WRC Plus, to three runs in two games. Now, James Paxton struggled, but you can't ask for much more than that.
That's a bummer, right? James Paxton. Imagine, you know, giving up on a better pitcher than James Paxton, who was on this postseason roster last year. Anyway, I liked what Aaron Boone said after the game, where he, I don't know how much flack he was taking for this in the real world, but certainly the Fox booth of Joe Buck and John Smoltz was talking about this a lot. When he gave the hook to Chad Green, who pitched extremely well in his two innings of work, and brought in Adam Ottavino, and he immediately gives up that home run to George Springer to tie the game at two. This is plan A for the Yankees. They have this incredible depth of pitchers. They have starting pitchers, maybe not Masahiro Tanaka, but certainly Paxton and Severino, who you'd think that their stuff would play up more if they know from the start they're going in a shorter bullpen stint. You know, the Yankees brought out five just absolute top end short relievers one after another, after they ran out of those guys, Sabathia is good against lefties. Loaiza has incredible stuff, even if he couldn't really locate it. And, you know, they got down to like the last pitcher or two on their roster before the Astros finally found somebody they could hit. And, you know, what Aaron Boone said was, you know, somebody asked him, I think it was something about, you know, you ran out of pitchers in the 11th inning, and that's because Paxton only went 2 1/3 or Green only threw 26 pitches. And he said, I don't know, we gave up three runs in 11 innings. I think the run prevention plan worked, you know, and I think I think he's pushing all the right buttons, even though they lost this game, in terms of pitcher usage in this series. And I think that's the way that, you know, he's got a little bit tougher job from that angle than AJ Hinch does, when he could just roll out, you know, a traditional six or seven inning starter and then two or three solid relief pitchers after that.
He has a lot of pressure, I think, especially in these games against Verlander and Cole. It's important to note that if the Yankees want to win the series, they need to win at least one game started by those pitchers, because Verlander and Cole can start four times in a seven game series. And facing Verlander and Cole, you kind of get to the point where if you give up more than two or three runs, you're going to lose that game, especially given Verlander's history against the Yankees and Cole's history against everyone at the moment. But I think there might be something psychological to the point that, like, John Smoltz keeps making, and I think other broadcast booths have made in this postseason too, that when you bring in a chain of relievers, it's more likely that you'll find one of them who doesn't have his stuff that day. And maybe that's true, but think about the alternative. The alternative isn't bringing in only good relievers. The alternative is leaving your starter in more. And I think there's something psychological about, if a starter gives up two runs in six innings, we say he had a good game. But if six relievers pitch an inning each and two of them give up runs, we say, oh, that reliever didn't have his stuff today, because on an individual outing, we expect each reliever to go scoreless. But stack them on top of each other, and that's just hard to maintain multiple times through a lineup like Houston's. So sure, Ottavino didn't have it last night, but Green and Canley pitched 4 1/3 combined perfect innings. Britton was good. Chapman was good. And it's just hard to ask for more than that, because the alternative was leaving Paxton in to continue getting hit hard.
Yeah, that was not an option. I mean, like, it's the Twitter meme of if I were in Aaron Boone's position, I would have only brought in relievers to pitch scoreless innings or something like
right.
that. You know, exactly like you said, like that's the Yankees are in a position. And, you know, I think a lot of the teams that sort of build out the bullpenning model do run into that where they just don't have, you know, five absolute knockout relievers the way the Yankees do. But Aaron Boone can legitimately call on, you know, a really scary power arm pretty much for any moment up and down the, up and down the course of the game. So he doesn't need his starters to go more than a couple innings. And frankly, like, this is what the Rays did and came closer than I think a lot of people realize to knocking the Astros out, because they were able to just put together that chain of scary relievers. And, you know, maybe it's not as good as having Gerrit Cole when Gerrit Cole is pitching as well as, I don't know, anybody in the past 5 years in the postseason. You know, maybe like he's having like a Bumgarner level postseason through his first two starts. There's one of those guys in the world. And if you don't have that, then this is option B. And I think, you know, the Yankees have put together a really solid fallback option. And I think Aaron Boone's doing a good job of implementing that. And I will say, like, if nothing else, like they pushed Houston and Verlander to the brink. And they came out of the first two games of the series on the road against a favored opponent with a split. And I think that's, you know, you have to look at this as a win for the Yankees coming out of this weekend.
That's what I was actually going to ask you. Do you consider it a win with Cole pitching in game three and then potentially a bullpen game in game four? Like, I think it's just really tough when you're facing all of these pitchers. Of course, it's better than what happened in 2017 when they lost the first two games on the road and actually lost game two on a Carlos Correa walk-off. So there's some history there. But I think this might end up being the best chance they have to win a game started by someone like Verlander, just because it was tied when he left the game. And I'm really interested to see how Boone now manages his staff over three games in New York, where it's the only time in the series there will be three games with no off days. And Severino hasn't pitched more than five innings this year because of injury, and they're scheduled for a bullpen game in game four. I think there's just a lot of question marks, and it's better than he was last year when in multiple games against the Red Sox, he left the starting pitcher in too long and that cost them, particularly in game four with Sabathia on the mound. So he's almost overcompensated the other way, if you want to say that, by being too aggressive. But I think that's a better alternative, and I'm interested to see how that carries forward into a three games in 3 days format. New York was the only team in the entire league this year not to use relievers on three consecutive days. Does someone like Canley or Britton become available 3 days in a row in the most intense situations of the season thus far?
So the first thing you said there, I think, is the point. Like, that's the counterpoint to, well, you got a split on the road and you almost beat Verlander. It's if they hold that lead, or if they knock it, or if, you know, Joe Smith doesn't come out of the Astros bullpen, yeah, absolutely nails. You know, the Yankees could have gone up 2-0 on the road, and, you know, the series isn't over at that point. But that's a dominant position. Like, they had Houston on the ropes and they let him up off the mat. And yeah, this is the kind of team that will make you live to regret doing that. And so, yeah, I think that's a valid counterpoint. Now, the other half of that is, in addition to the bullpen games and Severino being limited, you know, I think, you know, I'd take my chances with, you know, does Hap start game four? Does Luis Sessa start game four? Who starts that game for Houston? Because what Tampa Bay showed us is after Cole and Verlander and, you know, Will Harris, I almost said Will Smith after Joe Girardi said Will Smith 15 times in the ALDS. After those three pitchers, things get a little bit dicey for Houston too, which is not to say that, like, you know, those are bad relievers. Certainly they all pitched well last night in game two, but they're vulnerable. You can get at them. And so I almost like the way the Yankees pitching staff top to bottom sets up for a bullpen game in game four versus Houston. And then game five, you go back to the Tanaka versus Greinke matchup, which I think is a, you know, that's a check mark for the Yankees right now. And that's, you know, maybe Cole just doesn't have it in game three. So I think that's a big thing. Like the difference between 2019 and 2017 is not just it's like it's the order of the way the Astros rotation sets up, because both of those series had the Justin Verlander pitching well in game two and the Carlos Correa walk-off, but Dallas Keuchel started in one game one against Severino, and so that's the
it was against Tanaka actually.
Oh, was it against Tanaka?
Yeah, it was. Tanaka gave up two runs, but Keuchel didn't give up any, because that was back when Keuchel threw shutouts every single time he faced the Yankees.
Right. Okay. That's I was there, but they you know, those games sort of blended together for me. So anyway, but yeah, they had that was the Yankees' two best starters at that point in time versus the Astros' two best starters at that point in time, and you're going to get the Astros have thrown the weakest of their three main starting pitchers already. And so you're going to get Cole at Yankee Stadium in game three, which, you know, you go back to 2017. And this was, you know, there were times when like Lance McCullers and Brad Peacock and those guys pitched well in the postseason in 2017. But the middle third against the Yankees in New York in the ALCS was not one of those times. So, you know, I think, you said it's not a perfect parallel, but it's hard not to think back to how those series played out. But I think the Astros might be in a little bit of they would have been better positioned to come back from 0-2 down than they might have been 2 years ago. But you know, this I could see a path out of this for the Yankees with a win. And I think that if nothing else, like the flip side of that is if the Yankees win two out of three here, they have to go beat one of Cole or Verlander, like you said, in Houston in game six and seven. And, you know, we'll see what happens. But you know, I think this is the outcome, I think, that sets us up for the longest, most entertaining series possible.
I agree.
And that's just sort of it, like as exciting as this game was, and as much as like at moments like I was just like, please don't let CC Sabathia's last major league appearance be letting up a walk-off home run in relief. You know, like there were moments where I was rooting for outcomes like that. But if the Yankees had gone up 2-0, that would have been a big drag, particularly considering how over the NLCS looks, not to spoil the second half of the show.
Well, it's like when I was watching games 3 and 4 of the Dodgers National Series, I, from just a pure neutral perspective entertainment idea, I didn't care who won game three. I just wanted the other team to win game four because I knew game five would be phenomenal, and it turned out to be the case. And that was kind of the case here. Tanaka was masterful in game one. New York had the big advantage, but then it was, okay, you beat Greinke, now can you beat Verlander or Cole? And that's still the challenge they face. And there's a day off. Everyone listening, enjoy just watching the NLCS game tonight and coming back tomorrow for another two-game day, one of which is Gerrit Cole versus the Yankees in New York, and that's going to be all sorts of fun.
Are you right? Are you chalking this up as an Astros win? We sort of danced around this. Game three.
I think it has to be. Severino allowed pitched four shutout innings against Minnesota, but I was shocked he didn't give up a run. At one point, he escaped a bases-loaded no-out jam, but his control was just all over the place, and I don't think he'll be able to get away with that against Houston, and I think it's hard to predict a loss for any team with a pitcher who's throwing as well as Gerrit Cole is now, but the thing with these games is these offenses are incredible, but with how good the pitching has been, like, I think low-scoring games have an interesting relationship where every single pitch feels like it could swing the game. And high-scoring games, if they're close, yeah, it feels that way too. But there's something different, I think, about like yesterday when there's a 2-2 game that's dragging into the late innings and neither team can really get anything going on offense. At one point yesterday, there were two consecutive hours without a hit. I think between Brett Gardner's single off Altuve's glove in the sixth and Brett Gardner's hit in the 11th, there wasn't a single hit in the game. So it just feels so tense and dramatic that, yeah, I predict that the Astros are going to win because they have Gerrit Cole going. But at the same time, like, when any single pitch can swing the entire series, because that's how evenly matched these two teams seem, it feels kind of foolhardy to do so.
Yeah, it's the difference between the nervousness of anticipation and the exhaustion of relentless action. And that's, you know, we're definitely getting the former. I think one reason you mentioned Severino getting knocked around and getting away with it without scoring a run. One thing that's like jumped off the screen for me throughout really the first five games of the Yankees playoff run in total is how well they're shifting. And I don't know like how much of this is just they're better at this than anybody else or how much of this is just luck. But they've got a fielder right in the line of every hard hit ball. We saw a couple of these over the weekend. We saw a ton of this in game three against Minnesota. They have their defensive positioning about as like they're as solid as you could ask for. And I think that really bailed out Severino. I think that honestly, that might have been the difference in game two.
The advantage the Yankees have is that with their defensive positioning, and they might end up changing it if like Giancarlo Stanton comes back as a DH, given his injury that caused him to miss game two. But right now, at least, it feels like they have above average defenders at third and second, and especially first. I think the ability of, for instance, scooping throws in the dirt can be an overrated skill among first basemen. But in game one alone, DJ LeMahieu made a half dozen great scoops that allowed for double plays and the like. And I think that's an advantage that they have. The Astros, of course, with Bregman and Altuve, usually anyway, and Correa made a great defensive play yesterday, are above average at every position too. So that's part of, I think, the perception I get that these teams are just great top to bottom, is they're not making mistakes. It really feels like the wins are coming from teams earning them as opposed to other teams losing. And that's fun. Like, it's a zero-sum game. The Yankees lost the game yesterday, but they didn't because of poor efforts on their part. The Astros were just a little bit better.
Yeah, you look at the, you know, this is one of those games that is going back to those Boone comments I was talking about, where like sometimes you're just not good enough. You know, sometimes the other team just wins, and you know, in spite of executing a good game plan well. Yeah, I mean, that infield, like you said, I mean, it's three shortstops and a gold glove second baseman who's 11 feet tall. So that's, you know, I guess those guys are just going to cover a lot of ground anyway. The flip side of that I do want to get to, because we've been talking about it a lot, is the Astros sign stealing. This has been a narrative since Tyler Glasnow in game five of the division series. I guess, well, we haven't talked since
then. It's been a narrative, yeah, for a lot longer than that.
I guess game seven of the 2017 World Series at the very least. And then the man in the suit. We really haven't talked since the end of the division series, have we? So this sort of came up again with Paxton in game two, that they were seeing something, or that, you know, certainly there was the game this spring where he changed the angle of his glove, as I'm like moving my hands around here, as everybody can see, to hide the grip from base runners. But like, we saw the Yankees are taking this very seriously. You know, we've seen Masahiro Tanaka checking essentially like a play card on his hat. There was a cross up with nobody on base in the first inning of game two, between Paxton and Gary Sanchez. You know, the Yankees are certainly taking this seriously. Even if I don't know if picking up on what Glasnow was doing was particularly insightful, because it seemed like a lot of people had figured that out. But the Astros' reputation, I think, is certainly changing the way the Yankees are going about doing things.
And it, I think, has grown to the point, you made this point last night, that every single possible thing that happens on the field that could be interpreted as evidence of sign stealing now falls under this umbrella of suspicion. Like, there was a video being shared last night of Bregman reaching base and saying glove in, I guess, the direction of the dugout, and then touching his helmet. And people were wondering, does that mean he's telling people to look at the glove? And as you mentioned, the Glasnow game in game five, there was a really great moment that the broadcast caught where, as he was leaving the field, he had like a little bit of a pep talk with Carlos Correa, basically telling him what to look for. So that was an obvious example. This example from last night is, was he pointing out something about Paxton? Was he talking about a glove for some other reason, and it's kind of unclear. But because the Astros have this history, you can't help but kind of wonder and interpret it through this lens, particularly when Paxton is giving up a lot of hard hit balls. And you're wondering, is that just because Houston's lineup is really good? Is that because they know it's coming? Is it a little bit of both? And I'm sure that if there's any more camera pickups this series, we'll be talking about this more.
Yeah, I think, I mean, if I'm the Astros, and I think Bregman in particular, because he seems like, I mean, first of all, like the fact that he's talking on first base, like that is not news, you know, that Bregman is sort of drawing attention to himself that way. But you know, it's never the one thing, right? Because even in the Glasnow game where it was so obvious that he was coming set in different places for his fastball and his curveball, like a couple of those hard hit balls in the first inning were just pipe shots. And you don't need to, you know, I know it's 99, but like you don't need to know what it is to hit that. And so, you know, the Astros are the kind of team. And I, you know, gun to my head, this is what I suspect was happening last night, that Paxton just wasn't that sharp. And, you know, a good team is going to tee off on guys. And, you know, I say tee off, he gave up one run. It's definitely in the Yankees' heads. And frankly, like that determined the series. It should be in their heads right now. So they're the Yankees are in sort of an uncomfortable position where they need to be very conscious of everything they're doing, you know, get there. Yeah, when I wrote about this before the series, I said like they need to pay attention to counterintelligence. But at the same time, like they're going to be thinking about that now at any point where they're on the field, you know, every time Bregman looks a certain way or touches his helmet when he's on base, or, you know, some of these other Astros players who, you know, might have a reputation for picking up signs like that, it's going to be in the back of their minds. And, you know, I don't know if there's a good alternative, because if you ignore that, then you could end up not noticing you're tipping your pitches or that you've had your signs stolen. So, you know, this is interesting to me, because it's one of those parts of the game that, you know, it's just so beyond the scope of what we think of as the boundaries of the sport, but it's huge. Like this is like an actual, you know, this is just one of those cool things that, you know, the game within a game element that I think even after, you know, watching and following baseball and reading about hundreds of years of baseball, that, you know, this stuff still pops up.
And Severino, who's pitching game three, was clobbered against the Red Sox in the ALDS last year. And afterward, it came out that they believed he was tipping his pitches too. I'd say to this point, once you get in the other team's heads, like if I were a member of the Astros and I reach base even on like a bloop single, I would immediately start pretending I knew what was going on just to get in their head.
Yeah, bring out like the Chip Kelly play cards, you know, mm-hmm. out of the dugout, you know, wildly gesticulating. Absolutely. I think that we're in like double bluff territory. So anyway, that'll be fun to see that unfold throughout the course of the rest of the week. So we will talk about that when next we time. Record next. Yeah. So all right. Thanks for waking up early and coming on to talk.
Until then.
Running your own business isn't easy, but getting help with a lot of the day-to-day challenges you face certainly helps. That's why business owners all around the country turn to LegalZoom. Over the past 18 years, LegalZoom has helped more than 2 million business owners get started. But every entrepreneur knows getting started is just the beginning of your journey. What happens along the way will determine your success. That's what LegalZoom's network of independent attorneys and tax professionals can help with. Knowing where to turn for advice on trademarks, tax law changes, and reviewing contracts puts you at an advantage. Plus, you'll save money by avoiding hourly fees, since LegalZoom isn't a law firm. Don't get distracted by legal hurdles and business questions as the year winds down. Go to LegalZoom.com today to find out all the different ways they can help your business. And don't forget to enter promo code MLB in the box at checkout. That's LegalZoom.com, promo code MLB. LegalZoom, where life meets legal. After a grueling 162-game season, playoff baseball is finally here. And if you're listening to this show, you know we're in the midst of two scintillating and well-played league championship series. If you plan on being glued to the couch for every inning of October Magic, glue yourself to the best couch out there, Burrow. Your Burrow sofa can handle the rattiest game day hang with a kiln-dried Baltic birch frame and durable fabric that's naturally scratch and stain resistant. Burrow is totally customizable. Pick your fabric color, leg finish, armrest style, and length, and even add a chaise lounge or ottoman. With built-in USB chargers, you can look up game highlights for hours after without worrying about your phone dying. And Burrow sofas are easy to set up and easy to move. You can always add or remove seats as needed. Burrow offers free one-week shipping, so you can have your new sofa set up by next week's games. For something easier to assemble than a Major League bullpen, a Burrow sofa is much more comfortable to be around in the late innings of a close game. And this playoff season, don't settle for your same old couch. Settle into a comfy new Burrow sofa. Get $75 off a new sofa and free one-week shipping at burrow.com/MLB. That's burrow.com/MLB for $75 off a new sofa. Hiring can be a slow process. Cafe Altura COO Dylan Miskowitz needed to hire a director of coffee for his organic coffee company, but he was having trouble finding qualified applicants, so he switched to ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you, it finds them for you. Its technology identifies people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job, so you get qualified candidates fast. Dylan posted his job on ZipRecruiter and said he was impressed by how quickly he had great candidates apply. He also used ZipRecruiter's candidate rating feature to filter his applicants, so you can focus on the most relevant ones. And that's how Dylan found his new director of coffee in just a few days. Now, with results like that, it's no wonder 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. See why ZipRecruiter is effective for businesses of all sizes. Try ZipRecruiter for free at our web address, ZipRecruiter.com/RingerMLB. That's ZipRecruiter.com/RingerMLB. ZipRecruiter.com/RingerMLB. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. All right. And now for the second half of the show, we have a man who knows a thing or two about the National League, the National League Championship Series, and the the matchup for second place in Cy Young voting between Jack Flaherty and Steven Strasburg that's going to take place a little bit later this evening. It's Ben Lindbergh.
Hi. Yeah, this NLCS sort of inevitably feels like the undercard in this championship series round, I guess, which I feel bad about saying, but you don't have the super teams. You don't have the 2017 rematch. You don't have the pitch tipping intrigue. You don't have walk-offs. I guess you have attempted no-hitters, but there just hasn't been a whole lot of action. And I think the matchups to begin with were not quite as intriguing as in the AL series, but the NLCS deserves some love too, so we'll give it some today.
Good. That's a really hard sell. You know, I really appreciate you coming in. Not that I think you're wrong at all. But like, you know, it's like the Nationals and Cardinals fans or National League diehards, if such a thing still exists, yeah, tuning in, you know, and, you know, Ben, Ben comes on and, I guess we got to talk about this, right?
Yeah, it's just got to give equal time to each series. It's just, you know, broadcasting doctrine. I've seen people describe the ALCS.
I don't think that's broadcast doctrine anymore.
No, but we're trying to be fair and balanced here on the Ringer MLB show, but I've seen people describe the ALCS as like the real World Series, which I think that's a little snobbish. I wouldn't go that far. I think we're going to have an actual
Bobby,
World
can
Series.
Can you make sure neither Zach or I said that in the first half of the show?
I'm pretty sure Zach said that.
All right. Well, I just called Zach a snob. I think, you know, the real World Series is going to be a completely legitimate series too. And the champion will be the champion of that series, not the champion of the LCS. But I think there is just kind of inevitably an interest mismatch here. And frankly, the AL games have been a little bit better, but we can talk about why the NL games have been exciting too, because they have been close, at least because no one could score. So inevitably, it's going to be kind of close. And of course, you had two pitchers making a run at no hitters, which is always extra exciting in the postseason.
Yeah, the Cardinals just sort of weren't a nationally interesting team as a playoff starter for whatever reason. And I really can't put my finger on why. I guess like the lack of, you know, they didn't have the 100-win record or the Nationals rotation or Ronald Acuna. You know, it's just something that maybe made them feel a little quotidian. But although the way that we're talking about this, I think all but guarantees a Cardinals comeback in this series and then an eventual, you know, 5-game upset over the Yankees or Astros in the World Series. So yes, if you're a Cardinals fan and you're feeling down about that, fear not. So But, you know, it's interesting you said, like, this is the lower scoring series, as if the, you know, the ALCS didn't have a shutout in game one. And then, you True. Know, like Zach said in the first half of the show, 2 hours without a hit.
Yeah. Well,
in game
we're back
two.
In the dead ball era here, just all yeah. around.
So, but the thing is, like, I don't mean to be reductive, but the way Sanchez pitched in game one and Scherzer pitched in game two, like, you know, I came out and said this in my recap on Saturday. You're not going to win if you don't hit. And the Cardinals are taking not hitting to a disturbingly literal level.
Yeah, 4 hits in 2 games. Jose Martinez has half of those hits and the only extra base hit. Credit to Nationals pitching, but also debit to Cardinals hitting, I guess, because it just hasn't shown up. And I get that it
was
cold.
I'd say two of those hits, you know, half those hits arguably were outfield misplays.
Right, yeah.
Between the ball over, the sort of, I don't know what happened with that double over Taylor's head in game two. And then there was the one that broke up the no-hitter that sort of fell in front of Soto that
yeah.
looked like maybe he was just playing too conservative or maybe lost it in the sun. Mm-hmm. You know, we're talking about 4 hits over 2 games. We could very easily be talking about 2 or 3.
Yeah. I don't know if it had anything to do with the shadows. Maybe that's something you're just obligated to say during the playoffs. It's the shadows. But yeah, they have not mounted much of a threat. And now, really, I mean, the Nationals, I think, were favored coming into this series, but this is about as devastating a start to a series as you can have for St. Louis. I mean, even just game one, like game one is never going to decide a series. But if you can just quantify how much that changed their odds, because that was the game of all of them that they probably had the best chance to win. The Nationals had their worst regular season starter going. And of course, you know, the games, the Cardinals had home field advantage in these games, and Daniel Hudson was even away for game one. So really all the stars were aligned for St. Louis here, and losing that game, not forcing the Nationals to go into their bullpen. I mean, their bullpen has thrown 3 innings in these 2 games combined, plus an out from Patrick Corbin in relief. So when you have Anibal Sanchez, the guy who is not really expected to go deep into games, like as Craig Edwards pointed out at Fangraphs before game one, he was actually the worst pitcher the third time through the order, worst starter during the regular season. So they were not expecting that length out of him. And this probably, like, this had to be a record for, like, most relievers warming up during a no-hitter when teams, like, didn't put together a threat at all. It wasn't like he was putting a lot of guys on base. He just really wasn't giving up anything. And yet the Nationals just seemed prepared to pull him at the slightest sign of a weakness, which makes sense because it's the playoffs and it's yeah. Anibal Sanchez. But the Cardinals just never really pushed the issue, and he went deep into that game, and then Scherzer was Scherzer. And now you had the 2 games that the Cardinals, you know, had home field advantage, and the 1 game where they had other advantages and they lost both of them. And now they've got to go back to DC and face Strasburg and Corbin. I mean, it's a very tough assignment. I think the odds right now at Fangraphs are about 89% in favor of the Nationals.
That feels about right. If anything, that might feel a little soft, because I mean, there are 2 ways in which I think the first 2 games could have gone worse for the Cardinals. One is if they had lost one of those games behind Flaherty. Mm-hmm. And the other is the pitchers that they did throw out there, Michaelis and Adam Wainwright, who is, you know, I want on his time machine back to 2009.
Yeah.
Those two pitched pretty well. And I think that they're, you know, they were never out of these games despite, you know, like I said, almost a literal inability to hit. But at the same time, like, even when those no-hitters got broken up was almost advantageous to the Nationals, because, you know, you could sort of, in game one in particular, you could sort of, you know, see the smoke rising out of Davey Martinez's head, where it's like, how long do I have, you know, how long am I obligated to
yeah.
go with this guy? Because this is still a close game. And so, like, they never got to the point where, you know, Sanchez hit a couple batters, but they never got to the point where, you know, he's tired, he can't find the strike zone, he puts a couple guys on, and then all of a sudden the first hit of the game is a game tying 3-run homer. And yeah. the same thing, you know, Scherzer got pulled and gave up that hit when he was like right at the end of his rope in game two. And, you know, we could see, you know, just look back to game two, the ALDS between Tampa Bay and Houston, not to keep bringing up that series, but like, Garrett Cole was unhittable, and then AJ Hinch, I think, left him in a little bit too long. Travis d'Arnaud runs along at bat, and then he lets his last two batters he faces reach. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, you know, the tying runs on base. And so the Cardinals never even got into that kind of a situation because they got their one hit to, you know, break up the no hitter and make Martinez's decision easy, like just at the absolute worst moment. So if you're looking for a silver lining for the Cardinals, you know, things can't really go much worse. So, you know,
is that a silver lining?
I don't know. Like,
I guess so.
It depends on how bad you want it, right? Yeah,
it needs to go a lot better than this if they're going to survive this series. So, I think you can look at the series so far and say that Mike Schilt has probably distinguished himself as the oldest school manager in these playoffs, or at least among the remaining teams. Like, this is the second time that he has pushed Adam Wainwright into the eighth inning. And the first time he got out of the subsequent jam, this time he didn't, and they gave up a couple runs. And, you know, he's giving out intentional walks left and right, sticking with starters for a long time. But again, it's kind of hard to blame any of this on him or say that it really cost the Cardinals because they've scored one run in two games. And so, you know, I mean, I guess you could say that in that second game, they lost 3-1 and two of those Nationals runs came in the eighth when he stuck with Wainwright. So who knows, maybe something happens differently there. But yeah, this is it's a far cry from like Aaron Boone managing the way that he has managed and handling his pitching staff that way. Of course, these teams shouldn't necessarily do that. They're not built in the same way. The Nationals are going to ride their starters as long as they possibly can, which in this series has been a very long time. And it seems like Schilt doesn't trust his bullpen a whole lot more than Dave Martinez does his.
I'm not really sure he should. Like, the number of times I've seen Andrew Miller give up a fly ball and turn around and think, oh, you know, if the ball was the same as it was 6 weeks ago, yeah, like that would be a home run. And then it turns into an out. I don't have a whole lot of faith in the Cardinals bullpen, even though, you know, they've been fine through the first two games. They haven't been the problem, you know, by any stretch of the imagination. I think, you know, you wonder at this point, like, you got to try to get Jose Martinez in the lineup.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if maybe this is an overreaction, but maybe now is the time to overreact.
Yeah. Well, he is the one guy who is hitting. It's really hard to get him in the lineup, which was the issue all year. That's why people have been saying he's probably more of an American League type player for quite some time, and maybe he will be one in the future. But as of now, he's not really. And, you know, you don't want to overreact too much to the small sample and say that this guy who got hits in two games should now be our starting option if he wasn't coming into the series. But, you know, at some point you reach the level of desperation where it's just like anyone who is swinging the bat well, I want to see that guy swing the bat more.
Yeah, I mean, they got to win 4 out of 5. If now's not the time to get desperate, I don't know what it is.
Right, 4 out of 5 with another Scherzer start, one of those, with Strasburg, with Corbin. I mean, that's, and most of those games coming in DC.
Right, if they get to another Scherzer Strasburg start.
Yeah, that's tough. And you look back at the decision, Flaherty is starting game 3, and that's a welcome development for the Cardinals. I guess this is another opportunity to look back and think about what might have been if he had been lifted very early in game 5 in the NLDS and he could have started earlier in this series. I don't know that it really matters all that much. I've seen some compelling arguments that it doesn't particularly matter which games you start in the series if you're just going to start 2 if the series goes that long, because yeah, he might not get to pitch in a game 7, let's say, because there might not be one. But if you line him up for that game, that is such an important start that you get a boost from having your best starter in that game. I think the best argument for lifting him was not so much that he could start earlier in the series, but that A, maybe he's available out of the bullpen if it does go 7, if you can start him earlier. And B, just kind of like reducing the workload on him because he's been worked hard. He's well above his season high and career high for a single season in innings pitched. He's obviously had to pitch in some very high stress, high stakes games down the stretch and now in the postseason. And he just hasn't really done that before. So I figured, you know, save some bullets if you can. Don't have him go six in a game that you've already won.
What was it, 104 pitches that he threw in game five up?
Coming off the 117 or whatever it was that he'd thrown earlier in that series. It just felt like even if you do want to keep him on his schedule and his routine and he'd warmed up and all the rest and you're going to bring him back for game three, you know, take him out after three or four innings or something. Just save some stress.
Yeah, I think there are extremes, like the extreme like, oh, it doesn't matter, or the extreme like, oh, you know, don't have him throw a pitch and bring him back for game one. You know, I don't, you know, he's still a young pitcher. I don't know if you want to screw with his routine that much. I'm, you know, it might have still made sense to start him in game three, but yeah, like you said, you know, this game was over before, you know, before he put his glove on.
Yeah.
And they threw him for 104 pitches.
Yeah.
And not only that, like, you know, he hit Acuna in that game. Like, there's an outside chance, like, that ball goes differently. He gets suspended.
Right.
And it's
or there's
just
a brawl or something.
Or there's a brawl, you know, somebody gets hurt. And it was such an unnecessary, you know, I want to say risk, but risk implies upside. And I'm not sure what the upside was to having him throw six innings and 104 pitches.
Yeah, reading the post-game comments from Schilt and even, I think, from John Mozeliak, it sounded like there was just a lot of risk aversion that was going on there, where it was like, we really don't want some totally far-fetched, but, you know, imaginable scenario where this giant lead that we've built falls apart and suddenly you look silly because you lifted your ace because you took the win for granted. But frankly,
frankly, if any pitcher on your postseason roster blows a 13 run lead,
right,
you deserve to lose.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think you need to, like, that's not the managerial decision. You know, like, I don't think if they pull Flaherty after four innings and they blow that lead, you know, that's not Schilt's fault. Mm-hmm. You know, so I don't think that I really buy that level of logic. I think I come down where you do, where, you know, maybe you don't necessarily move him up, but just this guy's thrown a lot.
Yeah.
And if you can just keep him a little bit fresher for games, you know, for games where the win probability isn't 99% before he picks up the ball, you know, I think keeping those bullets in the chamber would have been smart. I mean, that said, this could all be moot if he gives up one run and Strasburg takes a no hitter in the seventh inning and the Cardinals lose another 1-0, 2-0, 3-1 game.
Yeah, right. And we talked about it last week. I think that the Cardinals offense is not really their strong suit. Like, they're a defense run prevention team. They excelled at that in the second half. Their offense was better in the second half, but on a full season basis, it was still like middle of the pack in the majors and the worst of all the playoff teams. So it's not shocking that offense would be coming back to bite them, but this is extreme. I mean, obviously it's two games and we wouldn't be making anything of this if it happened in any previous month of the season. It would just be two bad games or, you know, two games where they didn't hit and so what, but it's obviously magnified at this time. And look, Nationals pitching is good and the weather was cold and the ball is dead. So there are shadows. I understand all of these things. It's like, it's not inexplicable that this happened, but it's just really terrible timing.
Yeah, I mean, you said we might not have noticed. Like, I don't know, if you almost get no hit 2 days in a row, like, particularly if you're not like the Marlins, I think that might even get noticed if it happens in June.
Yeah,
I mean, but like, for want of middle of the road offense, you know, they're down 2-0. I think middle of the road offense gets them a split, considering how well they're how well Wainwright, Michaelis, and the bullpen pitched.
Yep.
So I mean, that's just, we just keep circling this point, but that's all there is to me, is if the, you know, Cardinals need to put some runs on the board and then we can talk. Because if, you know, I know it's obvious and reductive, but there's, you know, the game doesn't start until you put runs on the board.
Yep. And I hope that this becomes more of a competitive series. Well, it's been competitive, but I hope that it's a bit more exciting at least, and that it doesn't end up in a sweep or something, because these two teams, I think, you know, they're kind of like old school in a sense. Like, they're teams that steal bases and run and don't strike out a ton. And we've seen some of that.
It's very, like, National League.
Yeah. And in this series, you've seen like starters going deep. It's like kind of a throwback series in a way. So I hope it lasts a little longer than it looks like it's going to right now, and that the Cardinals can actually put some hits together or just get some hits, period, and make this more exciting and, you know, maybe get back to St. Louis. But it's just right now, it's kind of like, you know, you see two games and one team looks outclassed and then the next two games go completely differently. It's like the ALDS with the Astros and the Rays, where the Astros just look totally dominant and unhittable for the first two games in that series. Granted, that was Verlander and Cole, but it was like, all right, well, the Rays are just getting wiped away. And then the Rays came back and looked like the better team in the next two games, and they pushed it to a game five. So it's totally possible that the same sort of thing could happen here. It's just going to have to come against Corbin and Strasburg, and that's mm-hmm. pretty tough.
Yeah, there is a little bit of that. I made this point in the top half of the show that, you know, the Rays just, they looked, you know, they were, I think they were doing pretty well against two pitchers who just couldn't be hit.
Yeah.
And I, you know, the Cardinals are staying in these games. They're pitching well, they're playing good defense. You know, these games have been competitive down to the wire. Like the innings that Sean Doolittle's pitched have been fairly high leverage despite the Cardinals' total inability to score. Yep. You know, but I just wonder if this is going to end up being like sort of like the 2015 World Series, where the series only goes four or five games, but every single game is sort of tense and interesting on its own merits, mm-hmm. Even if the series just never ends up looking that close.
Yeah, that could be right. just some hard hit balls, just some deep flies. Like, other than the Ozuna fly out, it isn't even like the dejuiced ball has been robbing the Cardinals of a whole lot of big hits. It's just that they haven't even come close enough to threaten one. And I think the Nats deserve some credit for that. Like, Scherzer has been thrown hard, like harder than he did during the regular season. It seems like he is healthy and back to full strength or close to it after his back and shoulder issues. And I think Sanchez did a good job of maybe maximizing his strengths and the Cardinals' weaknesses, as was pointed out elsewhere. Cardinals are a good, like, four-seam fastball hitting team, and he was throwing a ton of sinkers, more sinkers than he usually does, and he just had really good command, and, you know, he was on. It wasn't like the Cardinals just got themselves out necessarily. I think he was pitching very well and targeting their weaknesses, but yeah, I mean, as you said, it has to get a bit better from here, I would think, and maybe with Flaherty going, that is the day that it happens.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because I think there is a tendency to just look at the totality of what the Cardinals have done or what they've failed to do. And, you know, looking at Anibal Sanchez as being the the one guy who's starting postseason games for the Washington Nationals who isn't one of those $500 million guys, and think, oh, look at this joker. They can't even hit him, but he's pitched incredibly well. Even dating back to the division series, you know, he really kept the Dodgers on their heels. And it's fun to see. I love just savvy old veterans who can just throw junk past anyone. Yeah. There was a phrase that I heard either in his start against the LA or in his game one start, Anibal Sanchez's other changeup, that like is like, what a titillating phrase. Yeah. So I love a guy who has multiple changeups, and he's been incredible this postseason. Yeah. I think there is some of the Cardinals just, you know, tying their own shoelaces together here, but a lesser performance would have given them an opportunity to give up get off to a better start. I think the Nationals have to be absolutely thrilled with the way Sanchez.
Yeah. And I also love it when a guy goes through that phase where he's aging and he loses some stuff and he has to find himself again, which is very much what Sanchez did. You know, he was more of a hard thrower in his prime, and then he had that trio of pretty terrible years for the Tigers. And I think all of us wrote him off, and he, you know, kind of altered the way that he was pitching to compensate for his declining stuff. And now he's had this resurgence and this second act of his career, kind of like a, you know, CC Sabathia type renaissance, where you don't go back to being quite as good as you were at your peak, but you become a very solid, serviceable, respectable starter at an age and at a point where people had written you off. I really like that. You go through that turbulence and you figure out, okay, here's what I have to do differently to get guys out with the weapons I have.
Yeah, the Dan Heron
yeah,
thing,
right.
Where like, you know, the I throw 88 thing is you know, good for a laugh and all, but he did not always throw
right. 88.
You know, he used to be a Cy Young caliber pitcher, and he did the exact same thing that we've seen Sanchez do. We see, you know, I think you could say this a little bit about Zach Greinke yeah. too, that he's had to reinvent himself as he's gotten older. And just through, you know, if you could throw strikes and you're smart, you know what you're doing, then I think, you know, pitchers who want to, you know, take the trouble and the effort to evolve as their bodies do can continue to get guys out, even in the era where, you know, everybody seems to throw like Tyler Glass yeah. now. So, mm-hmm. All right. Do you think the series is going back to St. Louis? I'm going to make you make a prediction.
I will say no.
I also do not.
But I'll say it goes five.
Okay. The gentleman sweep.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's very you, the man who wrote about don't predict any yep. sweeps. What a coward. Yeah. Well, you know, we'll talk next week, and I hope, you know, you will have found a backbone by then. But,
all right.
Talk it's always fun. We'll talk to you again later. That will just about do it for this week's episode of the Ringer MLB Show. Thanks to Zach and Ben for joining me today. Thanks to Bobby Wagner for producing today's episode. Thanks to Carlos Correa, Anibal Sanchez, and Mike Schilt for giving us stuff to talk about. And thank you for listening. Enjoy the week's action, and we'll see you next time. Navy Federal is proud to serve more than 8 million members, including active duty military, the DoD, veterans, and their families. You will receive a lifetime of membership benefits with Navy Federal, and you can easily access accounts, transfer money, pay bills, and deposit checks with the Navy Federal mobile app. Visit NavyFederal.org/MLB for more information, call 1-888-842-6328, or download the Navy Federal Credit Union app. Message and data rates may apply.